This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer, in for Steve Inskeep. In your health, if you feel hungrier or you're noticing more cravings in wintry weather, you're not alone. Even though our climate-controlled culture is hardly in sync with the natural world, lots of people still find their appetites vary significantly from season to season. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
Ask almost anyone, and you'll get the same answer to this question.
Do you eat more in the winter?
Yes.
How much more?
A significant amount.
Hal Brewster's response was pretty typical. He's a lean, 28-year-old student at Georgetown Law School. And just how many more calories does he think he eats this time of year?
Probably 300 to 400 a day.
Really? That much more?
I think so.
And what do you crave? What do you tend to eat more of in the winter?
Chili. A lot of chili.
Aha! A savory, stick-to-your-ribs dish that's high in protein. Now, if you ask cardiologist Ira O'Keen why this happens, he points to our biology. We have primitive impulses, he explains, prompting us to stockpile calories for the winter ahead.
We are driven by things implanted in our brains a long, long time ago.
For evidence, he points to a study done in Atlanta, hardly a frigid city, right? Researchers closely tracked how much people ate from season to season and how quickly they ate it. Turns out, the study subjects consumed about 200 more calories a day, beginning in the fall when the days grow darker. O'Keen says we seem to be very sensitive to light, and less of it prompts us to seek food and eat it faster. That's what the subjects in the Atlanta study did.
And despite the fact that they were eating both more and faster, at the end of the meal in the fall, they rated themselves as still hungrier than in the spring. So what does that sound like if you look out your window and you happen to have a grassy treed area? That sounds like chipmunk behavior.
So the phenomenon's explained, right? Well, not so fast, says scientist Marcy Pelsha of the Monell Chemical Census Center.
I'm not disputing the possibility that people eat more in the winter, but I am questioning the assumption that this is our hibernation instinct coming into play.
Pelsha says there's a simpler explanation. Our winter eating habits are born of opportunity. There are more parties, better leftovers, more grazing in the kitchen, and more holiday feasting. At every turn, our environment is nudging us, actually cueing us, to eat. Sherry Newton-Diller says there is one sweet that calls her name.
Coconut cake.
Coconut cake.
Coconut cake. And so in the winter, that's what I get. I'm on my way there now.
Whether it's cake, Linzer tort, or your favorite holiday cookies, this is the kind of food that's around during the holidays. And oftentimes we associate them with good memories. A taste of pie can take us back to our grandmother's kitchen or another moment in childhood. And these associations make us want to eat these foods even more.
The stronger the link becomes, you're more likely to indulge in the plate of cookies.
Or the coconut cake. It doesn't take a scientist to see that this pattern of eating is a recipe for weight gain. So whether it's our biology, opportunity, or good memories prompting us to eat more, there must be a way to minimize the winter munchies. Well, think back to our lean, chili-craving friend, Hal Brewster. He told us that he's not a big carb guy. The dish he craves is full of protein. And the great thing about protein is that it's satiating.
There definitely does seem to be more fullness associated with protein.
Janet Polavy is a researcher at the University of Toronto. Her studies suggest that you don't want an all-or-nothing diet. That can backfire. So you've heard it before, but moderation, right? And try to balance the carbs with protein.
For lunch, instead of having a big bowl of pasta, have a smaller portion of pasta and have a chicken breast with it.
Whether it's pasta, coconut cake, or those holiday cookies, Polavy says it's probably best not to deprive yourself of the foods you love. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Of course, people share more than just information. Some cities offer car shares or bike sharing services. And today's last word in business is tie share, as in neckties. A year ago, former IBM consultant Zach Giddens and his friends realized they could expand their professional wardrobes by pooling their resources.
I'd just sort of call up a friend and say, hey, I've got a couple ties that I'm tired of wearing. Do you have anything? And then I'd drop by his apartment, watch some football, and we just like trade ties.
Their tie trading worked so well for them, they left their jobs and last month launched Tie Society, which operates out of Washington, D.C. Like Netflix's DVD by mail service, Thai Society charges a monthly fee and sends users Thais they chose ahead of time from a website. Gittin says their most popular Thai right now is the Astaire Diamond.
It's kind of a light iridescent pink with black diamonds on it.
And when a customer is sick of wearing the same tie, he sends it back and gets another. Of course, one could do what these guys did and start a business out of one's own home. There, you don't even need a tie. And that's the Business News on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And now we'd like to talk about two white guys who did more than just talk about poor black kids, but actually did something to help them. Back in the spring of 1988, 59 students at an elementary school just outside of Washington, D.C., gathered with their parents for an announcement that would change their lives. Two local philanthropists made a pledge to set aside more than $300,000 so that the fifth graders at Seat Pleasant Elementary School could go to college, all of them. Abe Poland, the owner of the then Washington Bullets, now the Wizards, and the Washington Capitals, and businessman Melvin Cohen, came to the school, located in a struggling neighborhood, to make the promise in person. Parents and students were dumbfounded. Some clapped, some cheered, some thanked God. Now those students at Seat Pleasant are in their 30s. Their lives have taken some interesting turns. The Washington Post's Paul Schwartzman has written about the students' journey from that afternoon in 1988 to now, and he's with us now. Also with us, Jeffrey Norris, one of the Seat Pleasant 59. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Jeffrey, I just have to ask you, when you walked into that auditorium that day and you heard this, what'd you think? Do you remember?
Slightly. It was a lot of chaos to the point that of misunderstanding because, you know, when you're coming from what they call quote-unquote struggling neighborhood, it wasn't that much talk about, you know, college, you know, and for that, you know, we knew more about the I Have a Dream, Martin Luther King speech than we knew about what was happening on that day when Abe Poland and Melvin Cohen came
so
to
it. So it was kind of like this abstract idea, like we're going to go to college. So what does that mean? Because it was more like that. I mean, you saw the adults reacting. So,
yes, yes.
And crying. And so you figured it must be something, but you weren't even really sure
yes,
what that meant.
Yes, I wasn't really, really sure at the time. You know, it was clueless to me until, you know, you get further on in life, you know, you start to realize, you know, what was the importance of that day, you know, and unfortunately that it took a little longer, but some of us grasped with others faster than others, you know, and, but, you know, as like I said, through time and strength, you know, you still valued what came through the I Have a Dream Foundation.
Paul, pick up the story there, if you would. It's a very interesting story, by the way. It's still unfolding in the pages of the Post right now. Was there a one of the through lines was it wasn't enough to just pay the money. It wasn't enough just to say, here's this money, right?
Right.
And
I mean,
how quickly did people realize that it wasn't enough to just say, here's this money?
Well, because, I mean, not every family, families didn't have a lot of experience with college. So there was sort of a standard was being imposed that they weren't necessarily going to gravitate towards. And I think that it just took a lot of time for the thing to evolve. And the kids, you know, developed their own interests. And so in the end, a lot of them didn't want to go to college. I mean, they went to college and it didn't work out. They really wanted to work with their hands. They wanted to be elevator repairmen or car mechanics. Or one guy ended up as a UPS driver, and that's what made sense for him. And But this idea that they should be in college is sort of instilled in them, and that's what they have to live with. That's where it becomes sort of a burden because a standard was imposed that they aren't necessarily comfortable with. And so what was interesting for me is that it sort of redefined the idea of success. What is success? What does it mean to be successful in life? And I came away with thinking that it's not necessarily to get a college diploma. You can do a lot of different things with your life, and it can work out, and you can be happy.
Jeffrey, what about you? Your life took some Some turns. Started out rough. You witnessed your uncle getting beaten to death when you were just 8 years old. That has to be traumatic. My children are eight. And, just the idea of having them see something like that just makes me want to cry.
Yes, ma'am.
And then you wound up having some problems with the law yourself. Mm-hmm. Before your sentencing hearing, you were involved in an accident, badly injured. The judge decided to give you a break. He gave you a break, right?
She gave you a break.
Mm-hmm. And then something turned for you after that. What do you think it was?
I believe, I'm spiritual based. So, I believe that it was a time for change. And, through facing 25 years to life on the charge, I got in two months before I got to sentencing, I had a flip on 50 going home.
Route 50.
Route 50. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. So it was tragic to the point that after that event and, when you dealing with the streets, you start thinking first and foremost that I don't want to get locked up with a wound. See, you have to, you're still dealing with what you have to deal with in the streets. And I didn't want to go in, so you were an easy target. So you could have been easily taken out, So it's all that's going through your mind. You don't never know how many years you're going to be doing. And then, and then on top of that, you get amity, and you have to look at it like it's a higher power somewhere, it's something, it's an intervention somewhere, not only with, TV shows, but
So now you are a barber and you look very nice too, by the way. I say your hair is looking sharp, so you must know what you're doing.
Yes,
and you're a minister of music. And Paul raised this whole question of, success. Do you feel you found it?
I believe I've reached spiritual success. Meaning sometimes you have to be grounded with things that is sometimes not explainable. And it's things that we do on a daily basis that comes out to understand that, it's a walk. It's an everyday daily process. And if you don't, if you don't keep your eyes open, keep your mind open, a lot of things could be more impacted to you than you would never, Sometimes you won't be able to, come back on.
I hear you.
What I love
Paul, final thought from you. Yeah.
What I love about what Jeffrey sort of articulates for all the dreamers is that the story's still being written. And it's really unfolding, and it doesn't end when you're 22. It just goes on and on.
Well, I credit you, but Paul, I did want to ask, since you did kind of pick up the story here, and I must say it's a fascinating and complex story, and I'm excited to read it because I actually remember it. I'm dating myself, but I remember when the announcement was made. What do you think was do you think the gift made a difference? And was there any through line that you could find in which kids it really did make a difference for?
I think it really made a difference for all of them. There were certain kids that were going to do great anyway, but I think an idea was planted in them that maybe they couldn't execute, but they will pass down to their children because they now have this idea of what life can be. And so if they didn't get through college or they didn't go to college, they're going to see that their kids go to college or they're going to put that kind of standard on them. And I think that should be positive.
I did see, did note from the piece that the girls as a group seem to do better in terms of the original intent, which is going to college. Is that true? And why is that?
Having a daughter myself, I'm sort of getting the idea that girls generally do better in school.
Okay. All right. To be continued, as you told us, the story continues. Paul Schwartzman has written a series looking at some of the 59 students who received scholarships from businessman and philanthropist Abe Poland back in 1988. Those stories are now in the Washington Post, and you can read them online. Jeffrey Norris is one of the Seat Pleasant 59. He is now a barber who is working on setting up his own shop. He is also, and good luck with that.
Thank you.
And he's also a minister of music at his church, and they were both kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Gentlemen, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Just ahead, if it's a little music you need to get you into the holiday spirit, then you may want to freshen some of those tried and true Christmas carols with jazz.
What we always want to do is communicate emotion and feeling through our technical prowess and musicianship.
Musician Marcus Roberts spices up some of our favorite Christmas tunes. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Back in the U.S., there is still no counting on an extension of the payroll tax holiday beyond the first of the year. That was the shock delivered yesterday by House Speaker John Boehner. He said the deal worked out by Senate Democrats and Republicans to keep that tax cut going for another couple of months would not pass muster with House Republicans. The surprise move by Boehner threatens to upend what legislators thought they'd finally gotten done before the holidays. Joining us now to talk about this, as well as the rest of what's happening in politics, is NPR's Cokie Roberts. Good morning, Cokie.
Hi, Linda. How you doing?
So, I'm doing good. So, what happened with Mr. Boehner? The House had approved a spending measure to keep the government going and had had big support. The Senate also reached a bipartisan consensus. The payroll tax cut, extending unemployment insurance, and yesterday it fell apart.
Well, the House Republicans don't like it. They don't like the fact that it's just a two-month deal. The irony here is that the Democrats thought that they and the White House had somewhat gotten rolled on this deal because it includes wording that says that the president has to make a decision about that controversial Keystone pipeline within 60 days. But the House Republicans didn't see it as the Democrats taking it on the chin, and they made clear they weren't taking the deal. Now they have to come back tonight and figure out what they're going to do.
Now, this is not the first time that politicians in Washington have thought they had a deal, only to have it be blown up by John Boehner saying that the caucus will not accept it. What is going on here? Has he lost control of his caucus? Is he playing some kind of negotiating game?
Well, he insists that there was no deal, that he did not give his proxy to the Republican leader in the Senate. Look, this is a very tough caucus, as you well know. The Tea Partiers came into Washington with no real legislative experience of give and take, and they pretty much want to take without giving. And they've been successful enough at it that they don't see much reason to change. And they're not worried about their reelection. They are all in safe seats. So Boehner is there as something of a sensible soul trying to get things done. And he lived through the Gingrich years in the House and knows that the constant confrontation is in the long run not a winning strategy in terms of keeping the majority. So he tries to make a deal and he gets pushback and then he goes public with the pushback. And his members see the reaction to that and it gives him some leverage with his own members. But look, in the end, these folks have been pretty successful getting more of what they want than anyone would have predicted with a Democratic Senate and a Democratic White House.
Now, the 2 months is the stopping point. It does seem to me that GOP members would not like to hear every month or so that they're taking $1,000 out of people's pockets.
True. And of course, in 2 months, you'd be right in the middle of the presidential primary season, and they don't want to hear about it then. And that is the sticking point. They seem to basically agree on how to pay for the payroll tax cut. But now the House Republicans are hoping that by saying that the Senate has left town without doing the people's business, that it will work for them politically. Maybe, maybe not. But the bottom line is, Linda, as you know, something like this in the end does get done.
Now, you were talking about John Boehner and his experience with Newt Gingrich, and we've been hearing a lot of criticism of Gingrich's speakership, plus a lot of criticism about everything else. Is this catching on, do you think, with Republicans in places like Iowa?
Seems to be raising serious doubts. That, plus ads against Gingrich by his opponents, plus endorsements that are at least backhanded slaps at Gingrich when Romney is endorsed. And he's been talking about federal judges and doing all kinds of things that voters find intriguing, but not necessarily what they want to see in a president. And so in two weeks, the voting begins. We'll see.
Cokie Roberts, thanks very much.